So I'm what you might call a fair weather fisherman. I like catching fish and I certainly like eating fish. But when it comes to sitting around waiting for fish to bite, I don't have the patience. I don't quite have the Zen mentality for it. At least that's how I felt before I heard this next story, which has got me reconsidering the whole thing. From producer Justine Sloan-Lees, this is The Complete Angler.
So I started in my 20s having never fished, and Tom Gleisner, who I've worked with for 30 years, said he knew of a lake hidden in the bush, maybe an hour and a half out of Melbourne, and would I come along and do a bit of spin fishing. So it was really more to go for the drive and have a chat. And I caught one, and we spent the day there, and it was instantly addictive.
Beginner's luck.
Yeah, and I just thought it was one of the most beautiful places on earth. And then I think I discovered the mountain streams, the Great Divide of New South Wales and Victoria, and then New Zealand, and that was sort of the escalation.
I started fishing, I think, probably when a bunch of blokes lived out at Patterson Lakes, and we had boats and we decided to fish. A lot of time to spare, and fishing sort of filled in that time. From there it just kept growing, more and more passion towards it. I found it became a way of switching off from work and life, and everything was just, by the time you decided you were going fishing, your mind switched off from everything but going fishing, and I found that really relaxing. I live here because I find the water calming. My life's basically built around the water. Everything I do, all our relaxation time, even walking the dogs, it's always down the beach. I have my lunch down on the water every day. I leave the job site, I come down to the water. It's a relaxing, and it's a place I can switch off. There's nothing else to think about. You're looking at the water, you're looking at the landscape, everything's just beautiful.
So part of it's about being outside.
Look, it's outside, and then it's the there's a reflective quality to it. There's a very, very famous book, was a novella called A River Runs Through It, and became a famous film. And at the end of that film, Robert Redford reads the final paragraph. I think every fly fisherman in the world knows it. And he finishes an emotional reflection on failing to understand his family. And it ends like this. He says, "Eventually all things merge into one and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I'm haunted by waters." Now, I've read that 1,000 times, and I still don't have a clue what it means. But the final sentence, "I'm haunted by waters," every single fly fisherman knows what that means. There's something when you spend a lot of time in the mountains that you've, I think, unconsciously conflated introspection and reflection on life with the inability to bottle and capture that feeling that you have. And there's something about, in your mind, you associate rivers with a failure to fully understand your own life. And the word haunted, I think, is the only word I do understand.
I waded deepening into the dark water. Evening and the push and swirl of the river as it closed around my legs and held on. Young Grilse broke water. Par darted one way, smolt another. Gravel turned under my boots as I edged out. Watched by the furious eyes of King Salmon, their immense heads turned slowly, eyes burning with fury as they hung in the deep current. They were there. I felt them there, and my skin prickled. But there was something else. I braced with the wind on my neck. Felt the hair rise as something touched my boot, grew afraid of what I couldn't see, then of everything that filled my eyes. That other shore, heavy with branches, the dark lip of the mountain range behind, and this river that had suddenly grown black and swift. I drew breath and cast anyway, prayed nothing would strike. The River, Raymond Carver.
So it's not so important whether or not you actually catch anything.
No. So there's a scale, I think, of emotion. I think when you start the day, one of the reasons I like reading prose and poetry about fishing is that generally everyone sort of distills down to the same emotions and feelings. You start the day going, I better damn well catch a fish. And if you catch a few, you go, you know what, it's not about catching fish. And if you don't catch a fish, you still say it's not about catching fish, but on the drive back, you kind of go, yeah, but I reckon it's still about catching one or two.
Do you feel like there's a battle of wills between you and the fish?
There is a battle of wills between you. It's trout, and I think this is why trout seem to... Well, it's got the brain the size of a pea, and you know that it's not really a fair fight, since, I don't know, what's a human brain, 2 or 3 kilos? And somehow they're outwitting you, and so that's a frustration too. But they tend to inhabit beautiful waters. In places like New Zealand, you get to see them, so you every stalker, hunter instinct in you is ignited, you know. But they're designed to outwit. And that just is a frustration mixed with joy, and, you know, it's very primitive.
I'm interested, though, is there some way in which going fishing is a legitimate way to get away from the wife and kids sometimes?
Absolutely. Again, it's my way of having my time. The pressures of being a parent, a father, a provider, to get away, and again, not to think about anything else but me and what I'm doing is a massive part of it.
But then, you, as you just said, husband, father, provider, you're bringing home the fish.
Yeah, always. My family eat fish regularly, a couple of times a week, which means I've got to go out and catch it, which is, you know, a terrible thing.
Summertime, and the living is here. A breeze nudges the empty aluminium boat as it drifts at the end of its rope, its lightness wallowing within it like a fat man who has fished all day and fallen asleep and is dreaming of when he was a little boy and weighed no more than a plastic bucket. Years of floating alone, fishing far from the tourist cabins shining like rivets along the water's edge, have bleached the blue from his overalls and denim shirt. His face has the flat grey sheen of a man with a failing heart, but he is all lightness now and tethered only gently to this world. Bank fishing for bluegills, Ted Cusa.
Fishing with my stepson, Robert Adamson. We wake by your watch on my wrist, its piercing silicon chip alarm, bat squealing, needling through our room in the angler's rest. We drink Coke from a plastic esky, with ice melting into newspaper-wrapped squid, the only unfrozen bait in town. In perfect dawn, we set out from Don's boats. The outboard ploughs us through a bay. At Juno Point, we cast out silver tobies, our new Swedish lures. Your pure graphite rod flashes in first light. Your graceful cast sails out fine as spiderweb. The smooth water mirrors the arc. A year passes in the minute it takes for you to reel in your first true catch, the rod bending, line singing, realizing strike, and the flash of fish fire. The final buck underwater dash of a school jewfish, its explosion in air, and for that split second of communion between us. Utter wonder.
Is it a battle of will between you and the fish?
Oh, definitely. It's definitely a personal battle between the two of you. You spend hours with each other. It's not something you catch within 5 minutes. You're actually fishing on them for 3 or 4 hours. And it's just a battle of will. It's so many things can go wrong on our end and so many things can go right on their end. Keeping tension on the line, it's a really hard fought battle. And as I said, they use every advantage they have, which is their size and their strength, and we have very few things we can use against them. It's more we try to stay connected to them until they give up to us.
Speaking of equipment, it seems to me sometimes fishing is a way for people to acquire lots of gadgets and toys, including motorboats.
Yeah, it's not a cheap hobby. It's very much a boys' toys thing. I like expensive gear because I know when I do get that fish, it's not going to fail on me.
I think gadgets and gear is a really underestimated factor in a male's life, and that's the background of the shed. It's people are constantly trying to explain the current craze in bicycles. And I go, you know, look at the gear. And sort of people gave up running when they discovered bicycles. And I think the graph is linear with gear. And, you know, in that old game of rock beats scissors, is gear beats no gear. The fly fishing reel is one of the most simple gadgets ever. You know, Thomas Edison didn't spend any time on the fly fishing reel. It's, in fact, in a lot of places in the world, they tie a line around a can. And they're not hard to find.
Now, the reel may be simple, but flies are another matter.
So there's a difficulty. It's a bit like the golf swing, is that you use all the big muscles of the body in order to precisely deliver that little bit of metal at the end of the club. And you, fly fishing's the same. You've got to use all of that coordination in order to deliver something that must be half a gram in weight. And for the fish, you know, they don't have a big brain, but most of it's devoted to spotting fakes. And so it's another passion that people spend a lifetime trying to properly imitate the correct silhouette of a insect on the water
at a particular time of year.
Right. And so in the mountains, they're often not fussy, and that's probably why I go there. But there's parts of America where, you know, it's a storied history.
From a river runs through it, Norman MacLean. It is not in the book, yet it is human enough to spend a moment before casting in trying to imagine what the fish is thinking, even if one of its eggs is as big as its brain, and even if, when you swim underwater, it is hard to imagine that a fish has anything to think about. Still, I could never be talked into believing that all a fish knows is hunger and fear. I have tried to feel nothing but hunger and fear, and don't see how a fish could ever grow to 6 inches if that were all he ever felt. In fact, I go so far sometimes as to imagine that a fish thinks pretty thoughts.
Tell us your one that got away story.
It was actually one that got away from Tom Gleisner, who I fished with. We're on a famous river in the north of New Zealand where every pool has a name. And I don't normally fish in that world. It's you go and stand in one pool and the big fish go up and spawn. They're big. They come out of the lake. And I saw one that he had on, and I think it was over 15 pounds. I mean, that's like a small child. And I just remember, and it got off. And he came down and goes, maybe he said, maybe it wasn't that big. And I still had the look of, my God, that was almost 20 pounds.
The one that got away.
The one that got away. We were 50 kilometres offshore at Portland chasing southern bluefin tuna. We were onto a school of 50-pound tuna. We had caught them. We had them around the boat. They were all free-swimming around the boat when up came a fish that would probably eat one of them for breakfast. It was at least 200 pounds and 8 foot long, 3-4 foot across the shoulders. It was just, seeing it in the water just looked like a Volkswagen. We continued to troll around and we hooked onto it and we couldn't stop it. And through angler error, we drove over our line and we lost it. But we never got to see it, but we're pretty sure we knew what it was. It was my blue whale.
One of my favourite writers in all of fishing, probably the favourite, is Brian Turner, who's a New Zealand poet, writer, biographer. He wrote of a river in New Zealand that didn't have a great reputation, and I wasn't planning on fishing it until I saw this sentence. said, on a fine day, a few hours wandering the grassy flats in the Reese is a tonic. Cicadas and larks sing in high summer, and the views of the Great Peak Earnslaw to the west, and of the snowfields above the beech forest cloaking the lower slopes of the mountain at the head of the valley are utterly splendid. And I saw that paragraph and I go, that's worth a day. It's exactly as he wrote it. There's an Australian author called Philip Weigel. Again, I once, with Tom, I went up into the upper snowy mountains. So it's about 4,000 feet. It's very fickle weather. They're wilderness areas, and so you can't just drive your car up. You have to walk
very
in.
Very remote.
Yeah, and so you start, and you think, oh, this is a great idea. And 10 kilometres later, you go, wow, I've got to get out of here. And he describes the feeling at the end of the day when you start doing an audit of whether it was worthwhile. Eventually, your burning knees, blistered feet and gasping lungs deliver you back to the car, which you've never been so glad to see. You drop to the ground, swigging the half bottle of lukewarm flat Coke you left on the back seats as if it was the elixir of life, and then you vow never to fish that stream again. So what if the fishing was great? Nothing's worth a walk like that. But the mind works in strange ways, and after an hour in an air-conditioned car and a whole bottle of icy lemonade from the milk bar in Corryong, the memory of the walk out is already being swamped by happier thoughts. It caught my eye because we bought a bottle of soft drink from the same milk bar at Corryong. It's funny, though. It's funny pastimes that produce literature and prose and poetry. And I don't think there's a great canon of literature about squash. You know, a squash court's the same all over the world. You know, tennis maybe has one or two. But fishing seems to have... I don't know a fly fisherman who doesn't have a library. And I think that everyone chases the same elusive thing, and that is, I had this feeling once, and I can't quite describe it. And someone has done it before you. And so I think that people treasure their library because I think in some ways it's a receptacle for feelings that you probably will forget how to describe. Mm.
Fishing, living, flying, writing. Kevin Brophy. On weekends, the fishermen come down here with enough equipment to keep them busy all day. They are rugged against the weather, and they know about bait. Their lines go in, threads stretching down into the dark, for they are hoping to hook something new this time. Rabbits watch them from the longer tufts of grass. Foxes are sleeping, and the birds do their invisible writing in the sky above, like poets who think they know it all and just need to make quick, enigmatic notes on blue paper, sometimes on grey or cream paper, then flit off to the next topic. Sometimes a pair of swans on the water will glide by the fishermen, showing them another way to be with water. The fishermen hunch down inside themselves then, so that they are dark lumps of consciousness by the water's edge, reduced to thinking about life, bait, and cups of tea, hoping to be visited by a vision or a fish. Instead, they are visited by time, which always arrives at the end of the day. The birds are writing about this as it happens, sometimes before it happens, for they know how the story goes. They are poets.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Mm-hmm. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys, you're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing instead of just a wishing. Oh, yeah.
The Complete Angler, that was produced by Justine Sloan-Lees, and her two mad keen fishermen there were comedian and writer Rob Sitch and builder David Higginbottom. Readings were from Fiona McLeod and Simon Maiden, and the studio engineer was Angie Grant.